Welcome to the Infernal Schoolhouse Podcast, Explosions and Fi. I'm Brian.
And I'm Aaron.
And this week, we welcome back our girl Friday, Sam. Thanks for joining us again, Sam.
Hello. Thank you for having me back. Great to be with you guys.
Always a pleasure. So, Aaron, what are we talking about this week?
Well, we are just coming off of a great day of medieval food and beverage crafting. And I thought it would be good to talk about what we've made and how a lot of it can relate to fantasy gaming of sort of setting the tone.
All right. So we spent a lot of time in the kitchen today slaving away at some very hot stove pan chaos. The food we made was very solid. We made some cabbage biscuits. We also made pottage, which is very traditional of our medieval food, what was available, all those things. But my favorite and also the most horrifying part of this experience was being in charge of 20 pounds of honey and caramelizing it over like an hour's worth of time, during which I forced Aaron to sniff the pot and verify I had not indeed burned it all, probably 24 times. But that was my favorite part, and I would love to get into that a little bit more.
That sounds like a Spinal Tap album, Sniff the Pot.
Oh my gosh. It was so funny because like he clearly knew it wasn't burning, but still was just kind of humoring me, coming over and just verifying for me to make me feel better. It was great. But Aaron, you should tell us how you first got into mead making. What sparked your interest in that specific ancient beverage?
Sure. So I guess there's a multi-part answer, but for one of them is like I always liked fantasy stuff or medieval stuff, obviously from being in the TTRPG space for a long time and having a nerdy mom. I mean, ever since I was a kid, I went to the Renaissance Festival in Texas, which I'm excited to go this year to the Colorado one. I do like that one, but the Texas one is massive, and it was so massive that Disney almost bought it out and is amazing. But one of my favorite memories there, which I went there with Steven when we were old enough to drink, or at least I was. And so I bought us a bottle of mead that was nice and chilled, and we drank it and walked around the Renaissance Fair, and we both probably had too much and had to take a nap afterwards. But really fun, and I really enjoyed the beverage. But then later on in life, you know, because I like a lot of different hobbies, I always keep myself busy, almost to a fault. And I got a book.
To a fault.
Verified.
But I got a book called Charlie Papazian's Joy of Brewing. And because I liked beer and just all sorts of different, you know, liquors and spirits and stuff. And I fell in love with the book, and there was a lot of great stuff in there. And then I got to the back of the book, and they had some really great mead recipes, including for, you know, some cactus flower mead and some other great stuff. I was like, this sounds like a lot of fun. And so I kind of fell into it because it's interesting and it's complex and it's simple. And it's like, it feels more artsy than making beer does. And I like kind of engaging both sides of my brain where it's like a little bit of art, a little bit of structure, a lot of fun. Mm. So speaking of all of what we did, since the two of you are first timers to this, and I've done this for a hot minute, what surprised you the most about the process? And were there any unexpected challenges or delights?
Okay, so I was surprised by the volume of the pots and pans. And also the most endearing memory that I have is when you put me and Sam in charge of pouring one ginormous bucket of something into another ginormous bucket of something on the floor. And then there was this like, are we going to mess up the recipe? Are we going to dump it on the floor? But also, are we going to like burn the shit out of ourselves if I miss? And I was very freaked out about that part. I was expecting it to be like a countertop kind of an activity, not a full body lift with your knees kind of an activity.
I was impressed with the lack of spillage we had. I think once we were in it, we were pretty confident about
it. Oh, we totally did great. We only dribbled just a little bit.
And the sticky mess was pretty easy to get cleaned up. So it was a lot of fun. I still am just flabbergasted at the amount of honey I saw in one place outside of a grocery store. It was insane. It was an insane amount of honey, and we were literally using a crawfish boil Cajun cooking pot situation. And I was like, there's no way we're going to need this. But we for sure did. When you have 20 pounds of honey and it's like the bottom quarter of the pot, when it starts bubbling up, it is within inches of the top. It was terrifying. It was just molten sugar.
And you, the two of you don't know this, but you're actually making a varsity level mead. Because you were making what's called a bochet, which is a lot of times they call it a burned honey mead, but it's not. It's more of a caramelized honey mead. And the whole premise behind that is you take a bunch of honey and you cook it until it caramelizes. And then you do a lot of quick changes in order to prevent it from becoming candy and then turn it into actual mead. A lot of the regular mead making is just pour some honey and some water into a pot and then add some yeast and then you're done. That's easy stuff. I didn't give you the easy stuff.
Yeah, I remember my aunt Connie. She used to make caramel pie and it was incredibly fraught with danger because she would boil cans of sugar. And every blue moon, one of them would explode like a grenade. And I was like, well, what do you do if one explodes? And she's like, well, hopefully you're not in the kitchen when that happens. I'm like, well, what if you are? What if you're in the kitchen?
It never happened. So.
I just kind of imagine Aunt Connie just taking a drag and a cigarette is like, this is what keeps me alive, Brian.
I know that you have never met Aunt Connie, but you just embodied her very essence.
You get her.
Yeah, just taking a big fat drag on a cigarette and just powering on. Okay, so Aaron, talk to us about some of the essential tools and equipment that is required in mead making.
Yeah, so if you were to ask a Viking, they would just say like a vessel and then some yeast and then thyme. But we're not making trash mead necessarily, and we don't have a lot of weird things going on in houses and pets and everything else. So you're definitely going to want a fermenter. Fermenters you can get kind of anywhere. I would start with a 1 gallon if you're getting into this for the first time. That way, when you ruin it, which you probably will, or at least not come up to what you want to have, then at least you're giving it a try and seeing where it goes. Then you also need usually something to lock that down, an airlock, and then a lid. And the really important one is sanitizer. Oh my God, that's like, you sanitize so much that you're actually going to like dry your hands out because you always have to sanitize constantly to not have weird things grow inside of a mead that shouldn't be there in the first place. But then the other, like Sam mentioned, is honey. You need so much honey. It's like an insane amount of honey, like almost close to 3 pounds of honey per gallon of mead that you make. And so a lot of people can't fathom what that is from a standpoint, but it's a lot of those little bears, a lot of
like
them.
How many?
So those are usually about 8 ounces. So for that, oh you know,
so you piss off your local grocer when you buy all this honey?
No, well, see, I don't buy it at the grocery. You can
jars.
You can, okay. But also, you know, we'll get into this later, I'm sure, but there's a lot of different ways that you would source honey. And usually people who do sell it, more of the artisanal honeys or the wildflower honeys, are going to give it to you in bulk anyway. But yes, you can go and really piss off your grocery store.
I would like 89 honey bears, please.
Okay. So let's just talk really fast about the quality and types of honey, because you already mentioned it.
Yes. But
flavor profile wise, mm-hmm. I know I adore honey. I'm a tea drinker. My favorite is specifically sourced from very close to a large rose garden. So it's rose kind of flavored honey. But I know there's lavender honey from France is where they source that a lot. There's a lot of different kinds. Clover. What does that do once it's gone through this process? How does that impact the final flavor profile?
For sure. I'll start off by saying that the process you're speaking of takes a lot of time. So it actually, like the challenging part of mead is that there's a lot of time involved in making it because it has to essentially mellow out over time. There's like a lot of different steps into making it better. Some people condition in bottles, some people condition in the secondary fermenter. We don't have to get into all the technicals here, but going back to your question, the reality of it is that all of those different types of honeys and the flowers they come from give a different flavor profile for the meads. So if you're going with just a basic mead, you can go with some easy clover honey or some, you know, just general wildflower honey that you'd find at a store. Those are nice and easy. But as you get into the more complex flavors, like a rose or anything else, anything fruity, they're going to impart those notes on the honey. And the thing that's great about mead is it's a very delicate flavor. So as you have this very delicate thing, it's not like red wine where you're like, oh, I love the tannins or cat piss, which by the way is a actual descriptor for a different kind of flavor in red wine is cat gross. Piss or Band-Aid. But you won't have those in a mead unless you did it wrong. But what you will have are a lot of these spicier, fruitier, earthy notes that come through based upon where that honey is coming from on a different kind of flower.
What about adding other ingredients like fruit or spices? Is that something you've tried before?
It is something I've tried before. And that's where you get into these other different names of meads. So we're just using mead as a name to kind of, I guess, be a general robust name. But there's all these different names that kind of break them down. Like we have Bochet, which is the different kind of caramelized mead. You have a Metheglin, which is a spiced mead. So then you could then go and take spices and put them in a mead. But there's also a fruit mead. Oh, piment. Piment is actually very similar to, it's like a mixture of grape juice and honey. So it's almost like making a mead wine, for example. So all these different things can make things great. And it also depends on when you put them into the fermenter. So for example, for people who are listening for the first time, Mead actually goes through several processes of fermenting, just like making beer or wine. And they have a primary fermentation when most of that crazy, aggressive, yeast-eating sugar activity happens. And then you have to get it off what's called the trub, which is the settlement at the bottom of the fermenter, and then into a secondary fermenter where it's going to sit there and mellow out for a little bit and see what happens. A lot of the flavoring aspects happen in the secondary fermenter because it allows that to kind of seep in a little bit more, because a lot of those initial flavors are eaten up by the mead and you don't quite get as many back notes to them. So,
little bastards, drink your mead before you get to.
That's right.
Also, I feel like maybe going to a mead making Wikipedia page would be a great place to find D&D character names.
Oh, absolutely.
Bonch, yeah. Crochet.
Yeah, exactly. Or I am Piment Fizzy Whistle. I don't know. Yes. You know, something like that.
I love this. Okay. So for me, if I'm thinking about getting into this, I feel like I'm probably going to make some mistakes. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, have you made some mistakes, and were any of them noteworthy enough to share with us?
I have. And I like making mistakes because it helps me learn. But the biggest mistake is not being patient. Mead is not for the weak-willed when it comes to patience. If you're expecting like, oh, I'm having a party in a month, you're not having mead in a month. That's just not going to happen unless you want a quick mead, which is going to be garbage. Okay. But you need to have time for the fussle to burn off and then relax, then mellow. I had my first mead I ever made, which actually turned out really well. It was more of a show mead, which is the sweeter kind of mead. And it was good. It was good. But then I had some bottles that were sitting on the shelf for an extra 6 months to a year, and I drank it, and it was probably one of the best meads I've ever drank. It was really good. I think a lot of the mistakes come from the time. They come from not sanitizing enough. I have ruined batches of both beer and mead from not sanitizing enough by things that you'd want growing in there that get all gross, creepy, crawly, and nasty. Yeast can eat a lot of stuff, but they can't eat mold and mildew. It's just kind of where they draw the line, I guess.
Even yeast has standards.
That's right. And then also adding too much of a flavor. So maybe look at what other people have done. So if you're like, hey, I would like this one specific spice, like I want cinnamon. I've put too much cinnamon in a mead before, or I would like this fruit. But with fruit comes things. So I would just say do research. Like start with something basic, right? Start with just a basic mead. Just go with honey, water, yeast. You're good. Sometimes you need nutrient, very rarely, if you're just doing those three things. But then when you get beyond that, do a little bit of reading, do a little bit of YouTube videoing, and find out what you want to do and what else, you know, is going on the internet or in other people have tried before, because you can do too much of a good thing and then make it bad.
I do have a quick question. You've kind of talked quite a bit about the patience required.
Yes.
But I do want to ask specifically about the enhancement. You said that the first one that you made, the one that you left on the shelves, was better when you tasted it later. What's happening in that interim period that's making it better?
Yeah, so
party.
It's getting more mild. So, you know, a lot of alcohols, they don't, if you make something that's of a higher alcohol percentage, they have what are called fussels, which are these, I don't know the appropriate way to describe them from a layman's term standpoint, but essentially they're just other crap you don't want there that the yeast makes. And the only way for them to go away is when they could just kind of slowly dissipate over time and then kind of mellow out within there. So a lot of people, for example, won't even do a secondary fermenter. They'll just go straight into the bottle and let it age in the bottle. So my process normally is that I go from an aging in a secondary fermenter, and then I could then do an aging in the bottle. But there's this idea of just needs to hang out for a bit and see where it goes, right? Just there's a little bit of challenge because for those of you who are going to brew for the first time, it's not going to be as pretty as you get from the store because they do other, let's say, artificial processes to remove a lot of the sediment, and your bottles are going to have sediment at the bottom of them. There's nothing wrong with it. That's just extra yeast hanging out and not being cool. And there's other like yeast that are hanging around for a while that are just waiting to kind of flocculate and fall to the bottom, right? They're waiting to be done. And so you can't rush it because it's such a like a really harsh alcohol up front that it needs that sort of back aging in order to, you know, chill out for a little bit. Like making a nice cheese.
I feel like a lot of categories of life have fussles, just things that suck. And if you can just sort of like wait them out.
Exactly. Right.
Can you spell that word for me?
What yes, is it's F-U-S-E-L.
F-U-S-E-L. Okay. All right. I learned a new word. I've added a word to my lexicon today.
Yeah, most of the words coming out of Aaron's mouth tonight are not words I know, but I'm digging it.
All right, so I guess I would ask the both of you, how does the act of mead making that you got to be a part of connect you to historical traditions of brewing as you think about them? And then do you feel like a sense of craftsmanship similar to that, like maybe running an inn or a tavern?
I think that making your own product is something special. And I think there's this idea of, you know, bringing in the products of others and simply putting them on the shelf and pouring them for people is one thing, and not discounting that. But I think having your own product that you have handcrafted and then serve to others is a whole nother level of special. And I mean, and I honestly even thinking about like in a tavern scenario, in a fantasy game, I like the idea of having something that's just so special to that family or to that tavern that they're known for, that could be a source of pride, which could add some nice flavoring to otherwise you meet in a tavern kind of a situation.
Yeah. What about you, Sam?
I appreciate quite a few things about it. I also very much agree with Brian on that, because I don't know if this is going to make sense, but while you were talking, Brian, what I was thinking about is how different it is to have a beer fresh from the tap at a microbrewery than to get it somewhere else canned or something like that. It's a very different experience to have it at that point of origin. And there's something special about that. There's something more connected about that, that I think people desire out of their food and their drink. Like, it is such a like specifically needed part of our lives, and obviously not alcohol specifically, but food, drink, all of these things are integral to our functioning and in social lives. And I think that connection back to the origin point is really cool. So kind of what I went off of when you were talking.
Yeah. To me, like, I think this is really good to incorporate as a DM. You know, like I had this time when I was visiting Greece, and I was telling the Santa story, but I went to this Greek taverna where the word tavern comes from. And when you go there, they don't always have menus. You just go there and like, hey, what are we eating today? And they'll take you in the back and you see like mom cooking in the kitchen, like, oh, we're having octopus or something. And like, oh, okay, cool. Whatever we're having, you know? And it's like, one of the things I don't really like about Shrod is that there's this whole side quest about helping out this winery that's somehow supplying all of Barovia. And that doesn't happen back then. I mean, there's a little bit of that, but a lot of times all these taverns and inns and, you know, breweries are just providing their own product for people to enjoy. And so that's what I like to imbue. Like, if you're going to visit a tavern in my game, I want you to feel like the tavern keeper is excited about you being there and then excited about the product that they've made, because in real life they are. Sometimes also they're cutting corners and they're doing things illegal and putting things in those that are not appropriate. But that's also another flavoring that you could do in a game where it's like, oh, wow, what is this nasty stuff you're giving us? So
I believe that ends up with people getting flogged outside in the
comments. That is correct.
On ale being poured over them, for the record. But
that is right. Also, like, I love the scene in Gangs of New York where they're going into this like bar there in the middle of Five Points, and there's just a barrel called All Sorts. And it's clearly just all the shit they have inside of the bar just being poured in there, the remnants.
It's like the chug cup in
exactly.
Beer pong.
That's right.
Like, you don't want to drink that.
No. What are some modern misconceptions about mead that you'd like to address? It's definitely changed consumption-wise in recent years. I know when I grew up on the East Coast, I had never heard of mead until I moved to Colorado and was in Palisade. So I didn't even get exposed to it until coming to Colorado.
I think part of those misconceptions that I would say is that it's both more and less prolific than people think it is. Like, for example, in your case, Sam, a lot of people actually drank mead. A lot of people did. And it's actually a lot easier to find than grapes, for example. So they would have that more than they would wine. They might have that the same as they would have ale or beer. But then also, you know, those other fruity wines are very desirable because they're sweet and expensive. But honey is a little bit less expensive, a little bit more accessible. It's just more of the time aspect. But then also, in a lot of fantasy stuff you see nowadays, like, everybody's drinking a mead. I mean, that's also not the case, right? So it's like this balance of, I've never heard of it, but then also it's in everything now, right? So it's kind of somewhere in between is where you find the reality of what the world was. But also, mead is very important and was very important for a lot of things, especially for kings or for people who were, you know, I mentioned before about the idea of the Mazer's Cup or the honeymoon. That comes from the idea of drinking mead on a honeymoon, so that way you can increase your chances of having a baby of a certain gender, right? So all these things were a part of the reality of the time where mead's easy. Like I mentioned before, like, you have the Viking stick, which is the family stick that you keep in the house. You maybe put it over the fireplace or the hearth. And then whenever it's time for mead making, you would have your pot of honey and water, and you just take the stick, which has the natural yeast in the area they've used for so many meads now, and just stick it in there until it starts fermenting, and you take it back out and you save it for the next mead, right? It's just this very amazing basic craftsmanship that's existed for a long time.
Well, I have a question. You may not have an answer for this, but okay, I want to go back to the sanitization process that you forced me to go through aggressively. If I did not touch that spray bottle, yes, I was in trouble. I got my hand slapped.
And I did not slap any hands.
The threat was looming, however.
Visual, the eyes, the eyeball, right, got the right anger stare. But how do we go from the, the hangout stick for making mead to full sanitization? Like, what's the difference there between really old school and now? Just have different, what's that seems like a far shot.
Well, there's a lot of things that's a really big question to unpack. So I'll go with a few of them. One is that Vikings often made quick meads, which are more of the lower alcohol content, drink this every day sort of content. So really didn't matter if it was sanitized or not, because you're drinking it probably within a week or two anyway. Okay.
Okay.
The other thing is that they didn't really know what sanitation was or care. The third thing is that when you pay for 20 pounds of honey and you have to wait a year, you sure as shit don't want it to ruin while you're waiting for it to hang out there. So it's a lot of different things. So part of it is the convenience in the past of, I'm just drinking this tomorrow, versus now where it's like, I want to wait a while. This is going to sit here. I'm going to hold it at a very nice temperature so it doesn't go crazy. And I don't want to ruin my 20 pounds of, you know, honey that I paid for. So,
are we in a mead renaissance right now? Is that what you're saying?
I would say yes. We very much are. I remember when I was first trying to even find mead, the only one you could even find, which I have some upstairs, is Chaucer's Mead, which is, I don't even know where they're based out of, but that was really the only one you could find in any liquor store, legitimately. It was like the one. Now, I mean, there's so many of them. If you go to like Wyatt's here, I don't mean a name drop, but our large liquor store here in Longmont, there's almost an entire aisle of mead, and they're everywhere. There's one over in Boulder here, Redstone Meadery, which is really good. And so, yeah, I don't know how it would get more renaissance than it currently is. I think the only thing is that, again, is the time that's attached to it. You know, like, you could be a brewery. There's too many damn breweries in Colorado. But you could be a brewery, right? And you can be up and running within a month. You'd have your beers going. You know, the mead's going to take a year to have good mead that you'd want to sell commercially. So it's not for the faint of heart when it comes to startups. But we now have, I would say I could probably search right now and find at least 20 to 30 different labels at our liquor store.
That's awesome. Okay. I want to ask you, Aaron, about food pairing. So is there like traditional food pairings? I know the other night you guys made some really amazing dishes.
Right.
I'm including pottage, which I had never heard of before. So thank you for explaining that to me, Sam. But yeah, let's talk about pairing it with food.
Sure. So I'll start off by saying just a general blanket statement that most meads, and meads come in different varieties. They go from like fairly, you know, non-sweet to very sweet. So you would most compare them normally to a white wine, and then what you would pair those with, right? The difference, I think, is you're going to find more of the sweetness in the meads. And so normally when you have a sweeter mead, you want to pair it with something that's a bit more salty. So a good example would be when I was living in Hungary, we would drink Tokaj. Tokaj is this very expensive wine, which maybe one of these days you can come over and drink.
I have had that. That is what we had for my dessert wine at my first wedding.
Nice. We have that here. So we need to open this bottle at some point. But it's made from a very tiny raisin grape, but it's very sweet. And normally when I would drink that, I would pair that with a very salty, like pate or something on some bread. And they work so well together. It's an amazing balance. I don't like doing sweet wines with the sweet dessert. I think it's overkill. But you want to find the thing that balances what you're eating, like a lot of the humors and everything else you'd have in medieval food and cooking and, you know, doctoring. But for the most part, meat is great with fish. It's great with pork. I mean, you can drink it with anything. I wouldn't necessarily have it with meat, like a beef or anything like that. But you can certainly make it work with whatever you want to work with. But I think the sweeter stuff should go with the saltier stuff. And then you can kind of work backwards from there. So I guess now that we've made two different meads, which the other one I didn't mention because I made it by myself and it's quite silly, but I did make a Mountain Dew mead while they weren't here. And I'm excited to see how that turns out. But either way, for the two of you,
we'll find out next year, apparently.
Oh, no, it will be, that one will be sooner than next year. So don't worry, we'll be having that fairly soon. Okay. So I guess between the two of you, thinking about how mead works, and I'd like to make more. Are there any other flavors or techniques that you would be wanting to try in maybe a future batch? Any flavors, any spices, anything different?
Brian, go first.
I like the idea that you all were talking about with the honey that's got like the rose notes and some like floral botanical kind of vibes. And I think potentially this comes from my love of gin.
Nice.
And the botanicals. So I think that potentially could be something. I'm not sure if it would work or if it would explode.
We could do elderberries if you want in there.
That sounds delicious.
Okay, wait. I have a question. Can you infuse? So if you infused the honey ahead of time, would you be able to use that and maintain some of those flavor notes? Or is that different than the honey being from a bee that is visiting that specific type of flower?
So when you say infusing, you're talking about infusing the honey specifically or the mead specifically?
Either, because I do not know what the difference would be.
Okay, so the only infusing that would come with the honey would be on the type of flower that it pulls the honey from. So that's going to give you a little bit more of the, I guess, subtler notes that you're looking for in there. But from a standpoint of doing things, you know, you can augment a lot of the sugar because you always need sugar for yeast. That's what they crave. Honey gives a big part of that, but then you can augment with that other flavor. So like you can make that cactus fruit mead, or you can find other fruits to put in there. There's some complications that come with it. Like there's a lot of pectin in fruits that makes mead very cloudy. So you have to get things that would actually destroy pectin so that way it doesn't get as cloudy and weird for our modern palates. Now, a Viking would have no problem drinking weird, clumpy, you know, cloudy mead. But, you know,
we're on your chest.
That's right. We prefer the fancier kind, right? So you can kind of make it happen wherever you want. And the cool thing is that as you go through all of these steps, you are sampling every time. So like, for example, when I rack these, this is what it calls when you transfer to another fermenter, I'm going to see how they taste. And so if you think like, hey, I want to make a strawberry mead, for example, if you don't think the strawberry notes are big enough, then you're going to put a bunch of strawberry in the next fermenter to make it a little bit more exciting and flavorful.
Gotcha. Okay, so here's my idea. Going back to the Viking stick situation.
Okay.
I have always wanted to. My parents live up in the mountains, and I have read things. This was during COVID, if you can't guess from where I'm going to go with this. But sourdough bread, yes. Yeast, you can actually get wild yeast anywhere pretty much. And I don't know that you'd want it from like the middle of a city, but they live in the middle of this pristine mountain range area. And I want to get wild yeast and try to brew with that. I think that would be fun. And then if you got local honey, it'd be like this hyper local situation. Side note, they have a spring on their land. We could literally try to get it all from within like a 2 mile range. That would
Let's
be so
do
fun.
It. That sounds amazing. I'm totally done.
We're going to make mead off the fat of the land.
Also, there's a bunch of other complicated parts around yeast and things like that, but I'm excited to see what it does because different yeasts have different alcohol tolerances or sugar desires, rather. So there's a point where they just kind of eat too much, like Thanksgiving dinner, and they're like, and I'm done. And so that's where we have a lot of our different percentages, or we're able to guess what our percentages will be based upon how much they can actually eat. And a lot of those are all scientifically grown to figure out, hey, I need this one to do this percentage of stuff. But I want to see what we can pull from Sam's family's land and see what we can make out of that.
I think that'll be super fun.
Okay, so let me ask one final question before we finish. I know I just asked the last one. Do you feel more confident in being able to incorporate the idea of mead or taverns in your stories, having sat here and made it and understanding a little bit more of the process that goes into it?
I think 100%. And it's sort of like the part B of my earlier answer. But I think this gives me more flavor and maybe more motivation from the NPCs, because I think in a tavern, if the innkeeper, tavern keeper, whomever is just there to drop off beer or ale or mead, blah. But I think if they actually have their own motivations and their own desires and their own pride maybe over their mead, or maybe fear that you're going to understand that they've cut some corners or didn't do it right, I think that adds a whole nother dimension of reality and believability to something as simple as meeting in a tavern.
Yeah, for sure.
Absolutely. I especially think it adds depth to the player characters' interaction with the NPCs, because I think sometimes are not that we want to take over the whole game with a tavern scene, but they can be a little bit procedural And I think this would offer a lot of depth to discussion if you have an idea of what they might be making in the back, or one of the characters is interested in something about brewing or mead making or their processes, kind of knowing that back at that point, people could ask to sample to verify the product that was being made is kind of an interesting idea as well.
That's great. Thank you for talking with me about a bunch of honey and mead today.
So much fun. Thank you for letting us be your apprentices.
Always.
For anyone that might be interested in starting their own mead making journey, do you have any tips for getting started or finding a community of brewers so they don't end up with utterly horrible ones and maybe have a once in a lifetime experience with their first mead just like you did?
Yeah. So first of all, just do it. Like, get excited about it. Look online, find some first time brewing kits. But before you do that, before you give more money to that phallic rocket company, look up your local brewing shop, go there and tell them what you want to do and say, I'd like to get into mead making. Do you have any intro kits that I could pick up? And they will be more than happy to be there and let you help support the community and support a lot of these wonderful people who are fonts of knowledge and expertise that will be willing to help answer any questions you have ever. So they'll go in there, they'll help point out the different yeasts that you might need, they'll point out the equipment you need, and they'll also give you any ideas about what you might want to start with. And I think that's the best thing you could do. When you get beyond that, get on YouTube, find the things that make sense, pick up that book by Papazian. He actually has quite a few of them. And there's a lot of great mead books online anyway, or at your local bookstore. Find them, try them out. Don't be afraid to fail because you're going to, and then see what works for you.
I like that you said that about shopping local and sourcing local. Because I was thinking when you said that, sometimes people ask me, oh, can I get the D&D source books on Amazon? And the answer is yes, but don't.
Yeah, right.
But there's so many of these really beautiful little game stores in your town. Please patronize them instead.
Yeah, they really need it. I mean, we had this wonderful here one in Longmont, and it closed like a year after I moved here. And I miss it because it was a good shop. But this is like one of those amazing arts that's kind of slightly going away from the standpoint of being moved to all online or just to these monster commercial microbrews that are everywhere. Enjoy the art, like let it happen and have fun with it and go out there and find somebody that you can spend some money on who's there to help you and be a part of your community.
Aaron, thanks again for being our guide in this journey. And dear friends, thanks for spending time with us this week. Please check us out on our Instagram or at our website, infernalschoolhouse.com. Oh, and we sell stuff on Etsy too.
And a quick reminder, we are now live streaming our Monster of the Week campaign on Twitch. You can watch our bi-weekly live episodes at twitch.tv/infernalschoolhouse. Our next one's coming up on April 29th, but those only stick around for 7 days on Twitch. So catch our past episodes at www.youtube.com/infernalschoolhouse.
Thanks, everyone.